From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Evil Forces' Bill Bean joins us. Here's what's happening. Israel launching its largest offensive in the Gaza Strip in nearly 2 years, carrying out a blistering aerial assault on scores of targets, already killing 25 people in what officials called an open-ended operation aimed at ending weeks of heavy rocket fire as Gaza militants unleashed salvos on cities including Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Israel has mobilized 40,000 more troops along the border for a possible ground invasion. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi from WorldNet Daily. Jerry, this thing is getting hotter and hotter and hotter over there.
Definitely, George. It's a very dangerous escalation in the Middle East. I mean, when Israel calls up 40,000 troops, the government of Israel is indicating this is not going to be a quick or easy operation. And the violence that's coming from the attacks on three Israeli citizens and then a retaliation attack on a Palestinian citizen is escalating now into rocket attacks that can hit Jerusalem. There were 150 rockets fired today, one of which actually landed in Jerusalem. That's a major and frightening development because in previous engagements, the rockets had not hit Jerusalem. And I continue to say that, you know, the violence in the Middle East is never the solution. This is a very dangerous escalation, and hopefully it will not last long.
If it lasts long, I have a feeling that Israel will get to a point, Jerry, and simply say enough is enough with Hamas and just keep going.
Well, that's very possible, George, because there's indications that the ISIS group, the Sunnis, who have declared now a caliphate in Iraq and Syria, are also operating in Hamas. And if that's the case, Hamas is a much more radical and dangerous group, also backed by the Muslim Brotherhood, and Iran. So Hamas has both Sunni and Shiite backing, and Israel is increasingly feeling an existential threat facing enemies on all of its borders. So this could easily escalate, and that's always the problem with violence in the Middle East.
Okay, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry Corsi, we'll check in with him as these events continue to unfold. Americans love roller coasters until something goes wrong. Attention turned to an amusement park safety after a tree branch fell on the tracks, derailed a roller coaster car at a Six Flags amusement park Monday evening, leaving it dangling and its occupants stranded for hours. Four people were injured on the Ninja Ride at Six Flags Magic Mountain in California. They were petrified. The actor who gave voice to Pinocchio in Walt Disney's 1940 animation movie has died at his home in L.A., Richard Percy Jones, known in film and television as Dick Jones, was 87. Dick Jones, dead at the age of 87, cause of death not yet determined. Long-forgotten vials of smallpox left in a cardboard box have been discovered by a government scientist at a research center near Washington. Jeez, the virus, believed dead, was located in six freeze-dried and sealed vials, according from the CDC. It is said to be the first time unaccounted-for smallpox has been discovered in the U.S., that disease was officially declared eradicated in the 1980s. Now, they say the best treatment for Lyme disease is the prompt use of antibiotics, according to the CDC. But the CDC acknowledges that its recommended test can miss Lyme disease in its early stages. The complexity of the bacterial disease, coupled with a raging controversy in the medical community over how to diagnose and treat it, is confusing for both doctors and patients. And in what has been dubbed the Lyme Wars, camps have been divided between those who believe this disease can be consistently tested and treated effectively, and those who believe in a chronic and disabling form of this disease that is often not detected and is resistant to recommended treatments. Let's check in with Tom Greer, his book, Tick Bites and MS. Tom, I remember when you were on with me just about a year or so ago, we got a lot of phone calls about this. They still haven't solved it, have they?
No, absolutely not. And it's just as convoluted of a mess now as it was 10 years ago.
Now, some people are coming down with this disease. It's untreated. It's not diagnosed. And they can't even get out of wheelchairs, Tom.
That is very true for some patients. This disease can have many presentations. It can mimic many other diseases. The lucky ones have a multiple sclerosis-like presentation. I say lucky because those patients usually respond well to antibiotics. But those that have more of a Parkinson's-like or a ALS-like presentation, they often do not fare as well with the antibiotic treatment.
Lyme disease, you get it from tick bites primarily?
Absolutely. There's not much credible evidence that you can get it in any other way. Some researchers have suggested that recently infected lab animals, if you come in contact with their urine, say through a mucous membrane, that it's possible to get the disease that way. But the numbers of that actually happening would be exceedingly low.
Tom, give us some of the symptoms of Lyme disease.
Well, you know, what we really like to see is you get a tick bite, you get the traditional bullseye rash, which does not hurt. You would get fatigue, muscle pain, joint pain, and flu-like symptoms where you just don't feel well. If you see those symptoms, then almost any physician in the country can diagnose it. Unfortunately, most patients, I would say at least half, after a tick bite, may not have the majority of those symptoms. They may go weeks, even months, before they start accumulating symptoms like memory loss, extreme depression, fatigue, and then you backtrack and you see, oh, they had a history of a tick bite, or they were, it all happened after they were on a camping trip. And these symptoms, you know, it's really nice when you see the classic symptoms, but there's nothing written in the books that says you're going to get that progression of symptoms like that. You might go for 2 years thinking that you're just getting old or that it could be something else, and then you realize that, in fact, this was a treatable illness the whole time.
All right, Tom. Thank you so much. Tom's website, this is so important, canlyme.com, CanLyme.com. Researchers at the University of Michigan have found that despite Mars's sub-zero temperatures, small amounts of liquid water are able to form on the planet's surface at the right temperature and with the presence of salt, furthering the idea that the planet can support life. That's exciting. Forecasters expected a solar flare today, and indeed one has occurred. But it came from an unexpected source. Emerging sunspot AR2113 showed that it's capable of strong flares with an M6 class eruption. But thank our lucky stars it wasn't in the X category. But one day it could. It could take out our grid. William Forstgen joins us next. He's the author of One Second After. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I am going to use the resources of this program to do whatever I can to help people like William Forstgen and Michael Maloof to get our grid insulated against the potential attack of an EMP attack, that's detonating a nuke in the atmosphere, or possibly some kind of a electromagnetic pulse explosion from an asteroid or something like that too. William Forstgen, of course, has a PhD from Purdue University, specializes in military history. Some time ago, he decided, I'm going to do something about this, and he wrote One Second After. Now, this book was cited on the floor of Congress before the House Armed Services Committee, illustrating the potential damage of an EMP attack that would just about obliterate any kind of electricity in the continental United States. Here's William Forstchen. Always a pleasure to have you on, William.
It's an honor to be with you. And listening to your news items before I just joined you are all very disturbing. I'm glad you're emphasizing some of the points that you do.
Well, you know, all of it gears exactly to what you have been talking about for so many years, and that is the potential threat to us. And, you know, I just decided a couple weeks ago, after talking to you over so many years here, I'm going to do whatever I can to help back you, William, to get somebody in Congress, and I've already asked Nick Begich to ask his brother Mark Begich to get behind this, to try to get this grid insulated. I think this could be one of the best defenses that this country could ever undertake.
We're dealing with such a frustrating problem in that the cost factor is minimal per citizen. An analogy I like to give is if you have listeners who say have just bought like a $300,000 home, and you know, the bank says, well, we want you to spend $500 on insurance each year. And the response is, you got to be kidding me. I'm not going to spend that much. When we call that person an idiot,
yeah,
$500 properly insure their $300,000 home.
That's right.
We're not doing that with the infrastructure of the United States. We have built an elaborate, incredible electronic infrastructure, but we're not spending the several billion dollars necessary to at least properly ensure that some of it survives a potential attack from an enemy or, as you just mentioned, just before you went on break, there was a major solar event today.
Yeah, and we were lucky it was only an M6, but if it were a Carrington-type event, X flare could be a disaster.
Should I run over what a Carrington event is?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also want you to tell us, for those new listeners, just what is the difference between the two EMPs?
Okay. Let's start first with what an EMP is, an electromagnetic pulse. It is a byproduct of the detonation of a nuclear weapon. Now, we have to get away from our thinking of those of us who grew up in the Cold War picturing a nuclear attack as Dr. Strangelove or failsafe of bombs detonating over New York City and Los Angeles. It was realized back in the 60s that you could take a relatively small weapon, about 2 to 3 times the size of a Hiroshima bomb, if you detonate it above the Earth's atmosphere, about 250 miles up, the gamma ray burst coming off of the bomb in that first microsecond as it hits the upper atmosphere starts a cascading event, almost like static electricity or a lightning bolt strike. Free electrons breaking loose from oxygen and nitrogen molecules, they start cascading down in a chain reaction, and in that first instant, it hits the Earth's surface with intensity that could be as high as thousands of volts per square meter, blows through the power grid of the United States, short circuits everything off. 1 second later, America's without electricity. The congressional studies done in 2004, 2008 by a remarkable gentleman who's no longer in Congress, Roscoe Bartlett, stated that the casualty rate could be as high as 90% of all Americans would be dead a year later.
And when you say dead, they would die as a result of the things that happen when you don't have electricity, correct?
Right. People mistakenly believe sometimes that, oh, you mean radiation or the blast? No. In fact, you wouldn't even notice or see it if you know you were several hundred miles away.
Would you hear it, William?
No. It's above the Earth's atmosphere.
You wouldn't even hear it.
Remember that movie from some years ago in space, Nobody Can Hear You Scream?
Yeah.
Well,
same thing.
There's no sound. It's just a flash. It'd be almost like a flash bulb going off.
So no concussion? We wouldn't feel some kind of vibration off the chest or anything like that?
Nothing.
Okay.
Other than the fact that, say if it happened 2 minutes from now, you and I are talking, folks are listening, and then pop, all the electricity goes off. First instinct, of course, of almost everybody is, a power company, or there's been a storm, or a drunk hit power pole.
They have a little local power outage. Not the case, though.
It's a nationwide power outage. You know, Several years back, I live up in the mountains of North Carolina. We got hit by a pretty good ice storm, Christmas storm, I think it was around 2010. We went without power for 4 days. The guys who hooked my power back up from me were from a power company in Kentucky. Whenever we have a disaster, well, it's not a disaster, it was just a power grid takedown, you have help coming in from, say, 5, 6, 7 states. But imagine if the whole nation, the entire power grid is gone. That's when the dying starts. I remember some years back I was being interviewed by a Phoenix station where, you know, the host was a good guy, but he was rather skeptical about that 90% casualty rate. We go to a break, and the guy listening to the weather forecast. And they're saying, well, a typical day in Phoenix will be 107 this afternoon, 89 at night. Tomorrow, maybe up to 108. So we get back on. I said, hey, if you had no electricity anywhere in Phoenix, how many people would be dead within 48 hours? Phoenix is essentially uninhabitable without electricity.
He couldn't give you an answer, could he?
He couldn't. And he's suddenly going, you know, I never thought of that. And then my next question was, where does Phoenix get its water? Well, you need electrical power.
That's right.
So imagine now you're in Phoenix in the summer with no AC, and then also you have one bottle of water, and that's it. There is where you get the cascading events of people dying off.
Yes, and then the riots. And it's a disaster, William.
Well.
And that's from an explosion now. Then you've also got, as we talked about, the asteroid that blows up.
Yes. We could have that type of event, or actually, let's go to the Carrington event next, which is, it's named after an astronomer who in 1859 observed a solar storm explosion as it took place, what is known as a CME, coronal mass ejection. He's watching it on a telescope. And then a couple of days later, the new electrical technology of 1859, meaning telegraphy. The telegraphy stations across Northern Europe and the Eastern United States, the lines actually start to melt off of the power poles.
They fried.
And, in fact, railroad ties burst into flames from the electrical discharge from the CME hitting the iron rails with such intensity that it was setting the wooden ties on fire.
My God.
So think about how overbuilt that technology was. You know, if you can go into an antique store and take a look at like a radio or something from 1925 and look at how overbuilt it is compared to now. So we call that the Carrington event. That could be an event that could literally take out the power grid, not just of the United States, but of the entire world. But imagine what the world would be like 2 days after the power went off.
But it's fixable.
Not really.
I mean,
well, it's fixable before the event.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Before the event, you can prevent it.
Yes. It's an analogy I'm just making up at the moment. You say, yes, it's fixable. It's like you get in the car, you're driving down the road, and you hit the brakes, and it just goes to mush, and you go, heck, I'll just keep on driving. I'll fix the brakes tomorrow.
Yeah, same thing.
You're total. It's the same thing. Rather than spending the $200 to pull into the nearest garage and say, hey, listen, I need my brakes fixed now. We're all driving a car without brakes, in a sense. We have a power structure, but we don't have it properly protected against an EMP or a CME.
William, we're
wide open.
We're seeing what's happening right now in Iraq with these insurgents.
Gosh.
You imagine what would happen if they possessed some kind of nukes and the ability to launch into the atmosphere? And believe me, you don't have to launch from a country. You get on a boat and you get as close to the shore of the United States and you launch it. And there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, testimony presented before Congress in 2004 and 2008, and there was really no counter response to it. Is where is our most vulnerable point, and that is the Gulf of Mexico. Well, only a very, very small percentage of container ships are actually pre-checked and inspected correctly. Take a Scud missile, upgraded Scud missile, load it on something like a container ship, get into the Gulf of Mexico, get 200, 300 miles offshore.
Aim for the middle of the United States, right?
Pop. Yes.
There you go.
Send it up.
Stay with us, William. We're going to come back in just a moment. I've got many more questions for you. Plus, we'll then take calls next hour with you, William Forstgen, author of One Second After. And then we'll talk about what can we do? How can we wake up those that we elect to get this fixed? Because believe me, as I just said, it's fixable. Welcome back, William Forstgen with us. William, what made you write One Second After? What did you see? What event occurred for you to get you into this?
The day the congressional report of 2004 came out, I was in Washington, D.C. I'm friends with Newt Gingrich, and we've written several books together. I was up visiting with Newt, and he had just come back from the release of that report and was furious because media paid zero attention to it. Ironically, on that same day, the report from Congress about what happened on 9/11 came out. Media was all at that end of Capitol Hill.
Sure.
End of the conversation with Newt that day was him suggesting, Bill, maybe you should write a novel on this. Try and start building a constituency. He sent me over to meet the head of the committee the following day, Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, a great hero, wonderful intellectual, Ph.D., who got gerrymandered out in the previous just this last election. He said the same thing. He said, Bill, the problem is there's no constituency. Nobody knows what EMP is. So I write in popular culture. I write both history. I also write fiction. And 4 years later, I had a book come out called One Second After. And I got to thank you over and over and over because it's not just about writing a book and selling a book. It's about getting a message out. And I've been with you several times, and you're getting the message out. This is the biggest threat to our country. It could shut us down. And when you see footage of what ISIS is doing in northern Iraq, and you alluded to it in your comments a couple minutes ago, what would those people do if they ever got their hands on a nuke? Do you think they would hesitate for 1 second?
Not at all. Push goes the button.
And it's the best bang for the buck for them. Yes, sure. They could detonate it over downtown New York, and horrific as this might sound, kill 100,000 people. But if you could use the same weapon to blow off the power grid of the United States, resulting in a couple hundred million Americans dying, which one are they going to do?
And also, William, when that happens, and when our guard is down, when our back is against the wall, what do some of our other enemies who really don't like us, the Russians, the Chinese, we can talk about, hey, there's a relationship here, they own our debt, but what do they do to us when they know we're really, really weakened?
Well, you know, when we were talking about CME just a couple minutes ago, and the whole thing of the system's broke, it can't be repaired, the great vulnerability is, yes, an EMP detonates, takes our grid off. Even if the generating systems survived, it's those big high-power transmission systems that have to be actually hand-built, and there's no reserves for them. Guess where they're being made?
China.
Uh-huh. And so we send an urgent message, hey, we need about 5,000 of these. Oh, we'll take care of you in 20 years.
Yeah, we don't have any available now. But so
put the order in.
Yeah.
We'll get around to it. Yeah.
Jeez.
Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands, even perhaps millions of Americans are dying every day. We have become a third world power in 1 second.
Explain how the grid system is connected, William.
Some of us might recall, I'm revealing my age. I remember the great power blowout in New York City in 1966. And as a result of some of the power blowouts that we had in the grid in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it seems like a very logical idea of networking our system together. And essentially, the United States is networked down to several systems that are pretty well all interconnected. So if power blows out, say, in Cincinnati, Ohio, because of a bad storm, power can be moved from hundreds of miles away, perhaps from Chicago. The electricity that's powering my house in North Carolina might have been generated down in Florida. But as we've interconnected the system, it makes it more and more vulnerable to a major catastrophe, like one domino falling and then the next and the next and the next. It goes out of control faster than we can respond, and the whole thing is gone. And then we ain't going to get it back. The congressional study, and I attended a meeting on this afterwards, estimates are 80% of our electrical grid would still be offline 5 years after a major event.
Unbelievable.
Terrifying.
You know, when I finally leave this planet and go to wherever, that's what I want to be remembered for. I want to champion you and Maloof, author of A Nation Forsaken, and push this and get it done. I want one day, William, with your knowledge and what you do, because you're the hero, I want some president one day to say, these people save the country.
I don't see myself as a hero at all. I'm just the messenger. I'm just carrying a message. The hero are the American citizens who stand up and say, I want to make sure the world is safe for my kids and my grandkids. And not only look at this from the federal level, meaning the top down, I was just talking today with the representative from the state of Maine who pushed through the first bill in the United States to start preparing at least one state, Maine, for a possible shutdown. We can also move from the bottom up. And bills are now going forward in half a dozen states.
Yeah, they're starting to do this on their own now, aren't they?
Yes, and I see that as a powerful movement. Hey, the founding fathers were geniuses, and they pointed out to us, they created a system with the Constitution of state federalism. Yes, we have a federal government, but the states are supposed to be able to act independently on so many things. So even as I'm frustrated at the federal level, I'm becoming increasingly optimistic at the state level, which is far more responsive.
That's so true. Now, explain in terms of technically what the Energy Commission would have to do to get this ball going to insulate the grid on a national basis. How do they start? What do they do?
You take, as you're driving down the road, you know, folks listening to this, notice how many of those big high transmission lines we have.
They're right? all over the place.
Well, those are actually the major point of vulnerability. If you took one wire down between two of those poles and you measured out how many square feet they take up, you realize that, in fact, tens of thousands of volts of overload will be running through those systems. Now, if we build better, the technology is already there, of very quick responding circuit breakers that can snap off at the first instant of the beginning of an overload. We start, in other words, segmenting off the systems using circuit breaking technology, new circuit breaking technology, that can limit damage. That's one big step.
Then you go and fix it.
And then, yes, we will lose part of the system.
Right.
But an analogy I give there is, I remember when I was a kid, I'd go out in the backyard in the morning, you see a spider web that the spiders had built in the grass overnight. And being a typical 8-year-old boy, I struck a match.
Then,
you know, come on. We all have to admit we did
something. Those spiders
like
will get you, William, one day.
Hey, I opened my door the other day, and there was a giant snake sitting out on my front door. So I think they're waiting for
they
me.
They know who you are.
That was terrifying. But suppose that spider goes, boy, I got a crazy kid out here, and I'm going to make at least half a dozen fire-resistant threads. So no matter what that little booger does, my web will still be partially intact. How much easier, then, is his job to rebuild everything, things going? That's what we're begging for. At least spend the money on part of the system to start with. And also, the switching technologies, which are called SCADAs. You know, 30, 40 years ago, you had the old guy, you know, old Charlie sitting in the power station and say, hey, Charlie, throw the switch to this or that. Today, that's like a $5 computer piece.
Yeah.
It's a microchip. And fortunately, they are highly, highly sensitive to overloads. I heard one report where replacing those chips would cost about 60 cents a piece. But we have to replace millions of them, tens of millions, which control everything from sewerage lines to water supply to electrical grids and everything else. They're highly, highly vulnerable as well. So Let's not think so much about the actual generators, which in fact could melt off as well, but it's getting the power system out there. The high transmission lines are a major point of vulnerability.
Is there anybody in Congress right now, William, talking about this?
Yeah. In fact, a couple years back, gosh, I think it's actually before the 12 elections, about 3 years back, I believe, I could very well be wrong, a bill won bipartisan support at a time in which, hey, as we know, Congress was ripping its throat out, arguing between left and right. But a very liberal member of Congress and a rather conservative member of Congress co-sponsored the bill and went clean through, one to the Senate, and one member of the Senate, senator from Alaska, shelved it because it didn't have the perks for her state that she wanted.
Ugh.
Yes. I'm still raging.
Ironically,
bitter over that.
I'm trying to work with a new senator from Alaska, Mark Begich, to get this done.
Positive on that one.
Yeah.
The previous senator, she killed it just because the bill didn't fit her particular agenda. That's why I'm so leaning more and more towards pushing from the state level up. We get a bill passed in North Carolina. What's going to be the response of Virginia? In fact, North Carolina and South Carolina's power grid is intimately connected.
Well, let's say if Missouri passes one and insulates its grid in Missouri only, does that mean if there's an EMP attack or explosion, Missouri is insulated and protected and has power? Or is it still shut off as it comes into the state? Or does it just generate from within the state?
From within the state, the system could still be up and running. But let's take a look at how politics and logic works and realize we have, like, for example, in North Carolina, Duke Energy provides both in the North and South Carolina, and also, I believe, part of Virginia. North Carolina passes a bill. Virginia, the possibility is going to be a lot higher. They're going to push for it as well. Missouri passes a bill. What happens across the river in Illinois or in Arkansas or to the west? So that's why my hope is that folks who are listening to this, not only contact your members of the federal government, of Congress, but your local representatives are far, far more responsive and easy to get to and chat with. And just say, hey, look, look up the Carrington event. Go to Wikipedia. Look up the Carrington event. I want to make sure my state is protected. Will you work with us on this?
Read 1 second after.
Well, we could do that too. But in fact, I attended a hearing in Raleigh last fall, and I was startled by the number of lobbyists from one of the oversight corporations for the electrical industry who were there to oppose it. They don't want to spend the money on it. And there were some snide comments, of course, afterwards about, oh, gee, our electrical policy is going to be driven by reading a novel. So I said, well, sure, but why don't you take the information I used to write the novel, which is the congressional study. Anyone listening to us can go online and pull up the congressional studies of 2004, 2008. Just Google a search, EMP Congressional Report, 204 or 28, and sit back and read the hardcore information. You're going to have a sleepless night.
Oh, there's no question about it. How much do you think it would cost to insulate the entire country?
I've heard lowball estimates running as little as $2 to $3 per citizen per year, spread out across 10 to 15 years. You see, a certain percentage of the infrastructure is, of course, being replaced and upscaled every single year. So if we start it now in terms of just critical points, we're talking about several billion dollars nationally.
Nothing compared to what we waste. Nothing.
Oh, George, if we were not on national radio, I would be raving about 5 seconds from now about all the waste that we see every day. But I don't want to turn this into a partisan issue. It is a bipartisan issue because the day after this happens, you're not going to give a hang if the person who's dying and you're trying to help is a Republican, conservative, liberal, whatever. We're all in it together.
Beyond our show, William, are you getting much national exposure on this?
Yeah. I've done a lot of traveling. You know, I was out with you last year, to tape a program, and I was just with a group in Missouri a couple of months ago.
But, I mean, are you getting the network television folks to do stories on you and One Second After and the possibilities of what could happen?
Well, the book, when it came, actually, it's rather interesting in terms of the book industry. This book came out you and I first talked about this 5.5 years ago. And when it came out, it wound up on every major media source, and to the disbelief of myself and my publisher and almost everyone else, it was 12 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. So I can't resist throwing in that just 2 weeks ago, I finished the sequel to One Second After. And it's called 1 Year After, and it picks up the story a year later about how the community that my story is set in makes the first steps towards rebuilding. So that book will be out in December, and I assume at that point suddenly there's going to be a lot of interest again. But to me, it's about getting the word out there and getting people politically motivated and then actually doing the hard wiring to get our system prepared.
Well, you've got our support.
I've been amazed with all that you have done in terms of how you have put the information out there. I thank God you're out there doing this.
Oh, we're not going to stop. I've got my own little marketing thing involved, and you know, you're going to be there every step of the way because you're the expert, not me. And I'm just going to be the catalyst to get you the exposure you need, William, to get this done. And one day we're going to get a politician, albeit a presidential candidate, who simply says in one of his debates, I'm going to get this grid done. It's one of the big issues here.
Well, I recall a presidential candidate from 2012 who raised this issue in an early debate and was just greeted by some of the mainstream media with outright mockery, and that was Newt Gingrich's run for the presidency. Newt was at the forefront of saying, this is perhaps one of the two or three greatest national security threats. We got to prepare now. And he was greeted with scorn. It was very frustrating.
It's bizarre.
You can hear it from my voice. It was enraging.
Now, what are the odds? Give me odds now of an EMP attack or explosion.
EMP, every since mankind first figured out how to throw a spear at each other on through, every single new weapon system we have developed ever since the beginning of history has ultimately been used. Therefore, I believe the odds are very high that within our lifetime, within the next 5 years, we could see the use of an EMP. Regarding a solar storm,
who knows?
It is inevitable.
Right? Yeah.
No, that's actually inevitable. Statistically, it's inevitable. About every 75 years, a Carrington level event takes place. You know, George, I know you know, and I know quite a few of our listeners know, we are at this moment at a current high point of an 11-year cycle for solar storms.
And we've been lucky. There have been some big ones that have gone off the side of the sun. We weren't directly in front. But had we been, that could have been a mess.
Well, recall, I think the last time you and I were chatting, there had been one that, you know, how that the mechanics of that work is, you picture the Earth orbiting the sun. The sun is actually firing off what are known as CMEs every day. They're going off in various random directions. What's the statistical probability it's going to hit our little planet 93 million miles out? Fairly low. But when you have several thousand of these occurring across a span of 10, 20, 30 years, sooner or later we're going to get hit. The last time you and I were chatting, recall, if the Earth had been but 6 days further back in its orbit around the sun, that CME would have hit us square on.
Bingo.
Bingo, and we would not be talking or going to a commercial break right now.
William, we're coming back with phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.